and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest this hour is a German native who is now professor of religious history and theology at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Ulrich Lehner is the author and editor of more than 20 books. Lehner received the John G. Shea Award for the best book on Catholic history in 2011 from the American Catholic Historical Association for Enlightened Monks. Since 2014, he's been an elected member of the European Academy of Sciences and Arts, but his latest book is written for a popular audience, God is Not Nice, Rejecting Pop Culture Theology and Discovering the God Worth Living For. Professor Lehner, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks to be invited here.
Well, so you set up a kind of a juxtaposition between the God, maybe we could call the living God, and the God of pop culture. What's the primary difference between these two?
The God that we encounter in pop culture is described as one that is nice and ultimately not demanding much of us. It's a God that has lost most of the content of the biblical message. And the God that we believe in the church, on the other side, is an exciting God, a God that demands, a God that invites us to a challenging life, a God of adventure. And so ultimately, I think pop culture offers a boring alternative that we have to expose. We have much more to offer.
So the word nice suggests that boring pop culture option. Is that the idea?
Exactly. So when I asked my kids, of course, were teasing me, you know, about the book title too. But I explained it to them and I double checked, you know, did I get a good job explaining it to them? So I asked my 11-year-old the other day, so what does it mean God is not nice? And they nicely articulated, yes, God is so much more than nice. He is great. He is amazing. He's also terrifying. And then I realized, okay, I did a somewhat good job explaining it to them.
Okay, all right. That makes sense. What's the reaction you've gotten to the title God is Not Nice? Because it's startling. And I imagine you intended it to be startling.
Yes, and the idea for the book came actually from a similar book written by one of the new atheists, God is Not Great, title.
Christopher Hitchens.
Correct. And most philosophers and theologians would have said that the God he describes there is not the God of Catholicism, not the God of classical Christianity, but more or less a straw man God put together out of the weakest arguments from philosophy and theology. The other reason for the book title was that I wanted to address the lethargy that I find among students, among children, about faith. They go through many years of Catholic education, but they seem bored. They seem bored to go to church. They seem bored with the Bible. And I never really got understood why that was the case until I realized they were fed a very watered-down Christian Catholic message that indeed can be sometimes extremely boring and unexciting and unchallenging. And I think that's exactly what God is Not Nice wants to address.
Because they're not challenged, because there's no, as you said, adventure there, it's just easy to kind of let that God melt away especially in young lives.
Exactly. And I think we are losing most children and young adults already in middle school when they encounter for the first time logic and rational thinking on a higher level, and they are unable to reconcile what they see as contradictions between faith and reason and science.
Yeah.
Which is really sad, because that does not have to be the case, as Aquinas and Scotus and Augustine show us. But many parents are probably not up to the challenge or think that religious education would address that, but very often they don't. And then they realize that their parents don't have a good answer for why we believe certain things. Why do we do certain things? They think it's just a boring tradition. It's just a boring custom. If they don't see that faith is really life-giving, life-changing, life-altering and transforming, then they go somewhere else where they find their lives transformed. For example, in the gym, because you can see the results of how you get transformed. So I think this is a crucial insight that if we don't believe faith transforms us, it won't transform us. God is not just nice, but he wants to change us, turn us into saints.
So you say early in the book that this God of the Bible, the living God, makes our lives dangerous. What does that mean?
He makes our lives dangerous because we never know what happens next. If you think that with the God of Jesus Christ, we have a life that is secure, where we can plan every step ahead, then you haven't read really the New Testament or the Old Testament. It's a God who wants to interject himself into our lives, but that is only possible if we are open to his voice. And for that, we have to listen carefully. And if we do that, we not only hear and feel his voice, but also we feel sometimes his terrifying presence. It can be terrifying because of his demands, because of his majesty that suddenly appears in front of us. And he might ask of us things that can be dangerous. For example, risking our lives, risking portions of our reputation, risking our well-being for a task he has laid out for us.
Do you think this is why we have, for example, Peter in the scriptures, "Leave me, Lord, I'm a sinful man," that his immediate reaction to experience, to when he has a higher level experience of the Lord, is one of his own unworthiness and a kind of horror at his own unworthiness?
Yes, I think so. And one of the most striking experiences in the New Testament is really the change from the timid apostles to the fearless apostle martyrs.
Yeah.
First, they lock themselves up, don't want to talk about what they've just experienced from afar. They're, with the exception of John and Mary, the mother of God, and Mary, they're not under the cross. They can't even stand to be that close to Jesus. And that changes with Pentecost rapidly. And very often we portray this story as an unexciting narrative, as something bourgeois Christians believe in. And
yes,
if we do that, we destroy really the whole story. We don't show how these lives were actually transformed. And this is exactly what grasps the students and gets their attention. And I think it will also grasp the attention of everybody who listens to parents who try to tell this story this way.
Is there some way in which this pop culture idea of God, and I suppose I would focus on the word therapeutic, it's rooted in truths about God, but it somehow it somehow reduces those truths. And so the word, this idea of a therapeutic God is somehow just, it's not wrong as much as it's a diminishment of the God of mercy and the God of healing and all that.
That's right. The empirical studies about the faith of American teenagers are actually quite shocking. There is no other word for that. Most American teenagers and young adults reduce their Christian faith to really what we would have called a couple generations ago deism, where you throw out the belief of the Nicene Creed and reduce it to commonplaces like God is nice and he protects me, and when I pray to him, he will hear me, and things like that. God makes me feel good. If you only pray to God so that you feel good, that you feel worthy, you actually abuse God, use him as like a sofa cushion.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what Christians don't want to do and shouldn't do. The same question is when people ask me in theology, what is religion good for? And I tell my students it's absolutely useless. And first they're shocked. But it is useless because if you ask for the use, it means that you want to believe in God, but God is not the highest good in itself, but use it for something else. So religion stabilizes our society. So it's really not God that counts, but the side effects of this belief. And so whenever we encounter those arguments, we should be really very careful because we actually play into secularism. Whenever Christianity is reduced to some values, then it's actually abused. It's no longer a good in itself, but it's a means to an end. Whenever we use God for that, we lose God out of sight. And I think this is what a lot of young people experience correctly. And that's why they are very cautious about the Christian churches. So this is, I think, something that we can actually tap into. They realize hypocrisy very, very easily. And I think this is a good thing. And we talked about therapeutics. God is the ultimate healer, the ultimate doctor for our soul. But we have to articulate our needs. And this is, I explained this in the book too. A doctor cannot help you if you don't articulate your needs. He is the ultimate listener, the one who listens completely, where we don't have to put on masks or hide our little secrets. And that's the positive way of portraying a therapeutic Christianity. But that's not one that picks and chooses, but offers the whole terrifying and consoling reality of God.
And so after you begin the book giving us this image, which is a false image of God, and this kind of pop culture image, you give us 11 different images of the living God. And we don't have time to go through all of them, but I think you described the God of no use. That is, he's not useful to us.
Right.
But in let's take a couple further down, the God of thunder. What does that mean, the God of thunder?
The idea for this chapter came actually from a book by an Anglican theologian with a very similar title. It's called God Without Thunder from the 1930s. And he already lamented in the 1930s that Christians in the Anglican church, but also what he saw in European churches, had given up the belief in a realistic God who intervenes in history. The God who is described in the Old Testament is very much alive. He's not distant from us. And he's a God who sometimes can terrify through his presence when the ground for the reason for the existence of the universe is close to you. You are falling in a certain awe, in a certain, as the mystics would describe it, in a certain freeze. You can't move. If you read St. Teresa of Avila or St. John of the Cross, as a mystic ecstatic experience, we've lost touch with that experience. That is a terrifying experience. If you read the writers of the Bible, they're very clear about that. It's not just consoling and sweet, but it can also be terrifying, and it is terrifying. And that's the God of thunder. Thunder is terrifying because it's frightening. But why is it frightening? It's not because God is bad, but because God is so big, so infinite, and we are so small. And we realize that distance in that moment.
And so the proverb that wisdom begins with the fear of God, that it's not necessarily being afraid of God. But do you think that we've lost this maybe awesome fear at the idea of God, at the presence of God, because we've reduced God, or because we're grandiose ourselves, we've increased ourselves to such a great stature that it's not really, we're not frightened by the idea of God?
I think it's a little bit of both and then something additional. I don't think that necessarily humans are putting themselves up to be on the level of God, but we are distracting ourselves and we are numbing our senses.
Yeah.
And we don't see the mysteries that should terrify us. For example, the mystery of life, the mystery of death, the mystery of love. If you run, you can run through life without seeing those mysteries. You can just shut your eyes in front of them, or the mysteries of nature and the universe. And when you see the planning, the design, the structure of it all, it should terrify you that you actually play a role in it, and that the designer of everything actually has designed a role for you from the beginning of time. That is a pretty terrifying thought, because you actually play a role in the whole of the universe.
It is indeed. And then a couple chapters later, then we don't, or a few chapters later, we don't stay with the God of Thunder, but you say, you name the God of Intimacy. What does that mean? Our God is a God of intimacy.
One of the things that Christians believe in is that God is not foreign to us or distant to us, that he actually communicates with us, lives in us, especially with the reality of the Holy Spirit, and that with God we can be who we are. It's beautiful, as somehow the mystics say, with God I can be naked. That means that we don't have to put on masks, that we actually can, in our prayer, tell God how we feel, what we fear, but also what we hope for. And I think this is something very important. If we push God out of the equation and turn him into an old man sitting in a recliner up on a cloud that we can persuade to do whatever we want from him, whose only job is to guarantee a nice, cushy life for us, financial and health prosperity, then we lose the idea that we can be vulnerable. Because that God is a powerless God. That's exactly what C.S. Lewis said when he said, we don't really want a God who is in our lives. We want a grandpa God in heaven who can be pushed around, who can be persuaded, who is extremely genteel and merciful and so forth. But the God of the Bible is different. With him, we can be serious. We can be vulnerable. And it makes sense to be vulnerable because he's the only one who can actually heal our wounds, who can transform us, and who can perform the open heart surgery on our hearts that is actually needed. And that happens through the Holy Spirit.
And so we will go then all the way to the end, the final chapter of these different kind of descriptors of God, the adventurous God. And I think that's hard for, especially because to think of the adventurous God, because we have a kind of philosophical idea of the impassible, eternal, you know, changeless God. And this is hard to square with the maybe the God of the Bible, who does things and gets involved in stories, you know, and changes directions and all that. So what can you say to help us understand the adventurous God?
I think when we hear in the Old Testament in particular about God changing his mind, or God being wrathful, or having this or that intervention, Rudolf Otto, a German theologian, in 1917 wrote a beautiful book about the holy, in which he really explained what that actually meant. This is the way of the old Israelites to explain the utter difference of God. God is totally different what we can experience in this world. And you have to show this utter difference, this God who is a semper maior, always greater, with these images. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that's a very helpful interpretation. Now, the adventurous God, with that, I don't mean that God is adventurous in himself, against any philosophical theology. I'm very much following Thomas Aquinas's model here, but that with God, our life becomes adventurous. And I think that is important, because if you look at the lives of the saints, they show us that their lives were indeed adventures. If you surrender to divine providence, you don't know what will happen next. If you surrender your will, like St. Ignatius does, you suddenly become a tool for God's work, and he puts you in places you don't want to be. And that can be terrifying again. But if you take it as an adventure, and I gave you a couple examples in this chapter, then you re-enchant the world. Yes. It's not so much terror and fear, but challenges, and re-encountering the mysteries of this world, becoming childlike. Children are the best realists.
So when you say re-enchant the world, there is a quality of modern industrial mass society, scientistic in many ways, that tends to rob the world of its enchantment, of its mystery, of its surprise, and say, oh, well, we could probably explain that with a math equation if it got right down to it. So re-enchanting the world is a major kind of a work for our time, isn't it?
It really is. And I think philosophy and theology can really help us with that, but also really just common sense. Science helps us not to get rid of the mysteries if it's properly understood, but actually it makes us ask more questions. For example, you know, okay, you can put it down to you can explain a certain phenomenon with an equation, but why is that? Where does the equation come from? And why is the equation so symmetrical? Why is it so beautiful? So suddenly you have many more questions with the answers you just found in science. And I think that is something that many scientists are sometimes not aware of. When you talk with them, however, and they're scientists that have a little philosophical education, they would acknowledge that. And they would say, yes, you know, we can only grasp so much. And we are only good scientists because we are able to see the mysteries ourselves. It's mostly how it is portrayed in popular books or on TV sometimes that the mysteries seem to be explained away. But a true scientist would never say that, I think.
God is not nice. Rejecting pop culture theology and discovering the God worth living for, the newest book from Professor Ulrich Lehner. I will highly recommend it to you. And I'm going to tell you, maybe this is my way of recommending it. Dr. Lehner, I'm going to try to get all three of my young adult children to read it. If I can get them to read it, I feel like something might open up in their lives. Thank you so much for the book and for the opportunity to talk with you about it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Again, the book is God is Not Nice. Ulrich Lehner is the author. Thanks so much to all of our listeners for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. We'll see you next time.